Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us. Today, we're going to look at, from our public health segment, American healthcare exceptionalism. What does that mean? Well, for those that support Obamacare, which are most of your Democrats, those who oppose it, most Republicans, you're thinking, okay, so it's about who pays for it and the availability of doctors. What I care about is it's a terrible program. And that we're not looking at the fact that we have the highest costs in the world and the worst care of any developed country. That's not me saying that. That's the latest survey. So what are you really getting? We'll talk about that. From Health and Nutrition, bananas could prevent strokes. Honey is the solution for antibiotic-resistant superbugs, which are killing tens of thousands of people in the United States every year. What really happens when you take antibiotics? And what happens when you fast? You reboot your immune system, according to research from the University of Southern California. Then today, from the environment, we want to encourage our listeners from Oregon to challenge the governor who nullified the county-level bans on GMOs. We'll give you the latest on that. Then, University of Oxford College votes for vegan meals to fight climate change. That's good news. I'll share that. Europe bans American apples. Well, that's not good, but hold on. If Europe is banning American apples, why aren't we telling Americans what's wrong with the apple? And the New York Assembly overwhelmingly passes fracking a moratorium. Those are some of the latest on environmental issues I will deal with. But today is our commentary hour, meaning I'll be sharing in-depth commentaries on a variety of issues, including: why is the military-industrial complex, sometimes called the devil's dynamo? John Scales Avery, Countercurrents. Then, learning no lessons about war. From Consortium News, William Polk. Then, Americans are dangerously politically ignorant. How ignorant? Well, C.J. Wurleman from Alternet says shockingly ignorant and gives examples of that ignorance. I'll share that. And then an effort is finally launched to restore the core First Amendment democratic values. A statement by Robert Wiseman, president of Public Citizen, that was the group that Ralph Nader founded. They're going to try now to change Citizens United with an amendment. So I will give you the latest on that and the contact people so you can let your legislator know yes on that. So that's just some of what we have to share. And if time permits, fracking boom threatens the U.S. water supplies, and the mentally ill in the United States are 1 in 10. That's a huge number in prisons. And yet, they're not being helped. They're being tortured. So, as you can see, we take on a lot of issues. Let's begin. Bananas, organic bananas, are very healthy for you. And a banana could prevent a stroke, according to the latest survey. It's very rich in potassium. And when you realize that most Americans are deficient in potassium, and that means they're more susceptible to a stroke. So the latest study from Queens Medical Center in Honolulu, published in the Journal of Neurology, shows that having more potassium, in this case the banana, less opportunity for stroke. So I suggest a banana would be good, but also 300 or 400 milligrams of potassium a day would also be good. I can't tell you how many times in my life, maybe from a long lecture, being in a dry car for days on end, traveling, filming, your throat gets dry. I simply take some Manuka honey, like a teaspoon, mix it into a quart of water, and sip it. It's great for that. Also, at the first sign of any immune system challenge, more Manuka honey. Having a wound on your body that won't heal properly, Manuka honey. It's just one of the best all-around things you can use. This is the latest in Natural Society. And it's, quote, the unique property of honey lies in its ability to fight infection on multiple levels, making it more difficult for bacteria to develop resistance. That was presented at the national meeting of the American Chemical Society by Dr. Susan Minchwitz, leader of the study. Honey, and we're talking about raw honey, according to the doctor, acts by combining components in such a way that it creates an osmotic effect with polyphenols, and it's, quote, honey may also disrupt quorum sensing, which weakens bacterial virulence, rendering the bacteria more susceptible to conventional antibiotics. So, honey is a natural antibiotic with no side effects. Quote, 15 antibiotics were tested with and without sublethal concentrations of Manuka honey against the MRSA and Pseudomonas bacteria using disc diffusion, broth dilution. And they found that 5 novel antibiotic and Manuka honey combinations were found to improve antibacterial effectiveness in vitro, and these offer new avenues of future topical treatments for wound infections caused by these two important pathogens. So, quote, in fact, honey was traditionally used to fight infections up until around the 20th century. Around this time, honey was forgotten and predominantly replaced by penicillin, but is now regaining its former popularity as the world continues to become more conscious to the dangers of pharmaceutical drug use. So here's the takeaway message. Raw, organic, unfiltered honey, taken internally, is good for you, but you can also use it in a poultice on burns, cuts, scratches, scrapes, punctures, because it also helps prevent infection. And if you have the MRSA virus, which can kill you, I suggest a combination of Manuka honey internally, externally, and hydrogen peroxide, or excuse me, ozone. I want to go a little further. I read an interesting article by Raluca Schachter of Wake Up World on antibiotics. And we as a society take more antibiotics than any other population in the world. And they, of course, can be life-saving. But when you use them too regularly, then they're not. Here's the latest. Quote, antibiotics, one of the most prescribed drugs in the modern world. The evidence proves how harmful this practice can be when available for a while now. Taking a routine course of antibiotics, and moreover pouring them into our food, has been leading to serious and dangerous side effects, which greatly affect everybody's health and well-being. There are instances when antibiotics can save a life, but so they have their place by switching from specific, well-determined and occasional use to broad use and even worse, to prevent measures in humans and animals is totally insane. Antibiotics as prescription drugs. People become so uncomfortable these days whenever they have a sniffle or infection, they all want it to go away right now. But common infections don't equal antibiotics. Our body simply doesn't work like that. The whole length of our digestive tract is coated with a bacterial layer, providing a natural barrier against invaders, undigested food and toxins and parasites. If this coating, this mucosal barrier, gets damaged, that's dangerous. These beneficial bacteria protecting the gut wall also work against invading pathogenic microorganisms by producing antibiotic-like substances, antifungal volatiles, and antiviral substances. They engage the immune system to respond appropriately to invaders. Our healthy, indigenous bacteria has a good ability to neutralize toxic substances from our food and environment, inactivate histamine, and chelate heavy metals and other poisons. So that's all good. Now, the variety of functions and the essential intact mucosal barrier, a healthy gut bacteria, make this the root of our health. And what is the clinical reality these days? The vast majority of people have a damaged gut, and the major culprit is antibiotics. Dr. Natasha Campbell McBride offers a well-researched summary of the most common disastrous health effects which directly involve antibiotics. 1. They destroy beneficial good bacteria in the human body. 2. They change bacteria and viruses and fungi from being benign to pathogenic, giving them an ability to invade tissue and cause disease. 3. They make bacteria resistant to antibiotics. So the industry has to work on more and more powerful new antibiotics to attack these new changed bacteria. A good example is tuberculosis, where wide use of antibiotics has created new varieties of a mycobacterium tuberculosis resistant to virtually all existing antibiotics. And finally, they have a direct damaging effect on the immune system, making us more vulnerable to infections, which leads to a vicious cycle of more antibiotics and more infections. Now, since babies are born with a sterile gut flora, the mother essentially downloads her gut health flora into the babies through breastfeeding. No wonder why digestive problems are usually shown to get worse with each generation, considering the mother's poor gut health and bottle feeding. Now, the penicillins and other antibiotics, with the cillin, C-I-L-L-I-N, at the end of their name, have a damaging effect on two major groups of resistant bacteria, the lactobacilli and the bifidobacteria. This group of antibiotics allow bacteria normally found only in the bowel to travel to the intestines, which predisposes the person to development of irritable bowel syndrome and other digestive disorders. The tetracyclines and other cyclines, C-Y-C-L-I-N-E-S, have a particularly toxic effect on the gut wall by altering protein structure in the mucous membranes, making it vulnerable to invasion by pathogenic microbes and altering the immune system to attack the changed proteins. And then you have what are called aminoglycosides, and like erythromycin. And they have a devastating effect on beneficial bacteria such as the physiological E. coli and enterococci. And prolonged use of these antibiotics, the aminoglycosides, can completely eliminate the good bacteria from your digestive tract. And then when you eat, you get antibiotics in your food. In fact, they use over 30 million pounds of antibiotics every year just in animals. And farm fish and shellfish have antibiotics added as well. They're even putting antibiotics in fruits, vegetables, and grains, legumes, and nuts. They're sprayed with antibiotics to control disease. And then you have antibacterial cleaners. Germs do not cause disease as such in general. Nature never surrounded her children with enemies. It is the individual himself who makes disease possible in his own body because of poor living habits. Do mosquitoes make the water stagnant? Or does stagnant water attract the mosquitoes? We should be taught that germs can be either constructive or destructive, can promote health or disease. And so we have to be aware that the medium in which they're maintained makes all the difference in the world. And that is the key here. So we're using way too many antibiotics. And as a result, we end up with what is called CRE, and that is a highly drug-resistant bacteria. In fact, it's been found in many places and in hospitals, and it kills people, and that's because we've used too much. So, first and foremost, antibiotics can be good, can save lives, but not if you've been using them your whole life. I published a book in 1974. It was called Body Pollution. In it, I had a chapter on antibiotics in the big meat industry. And at that time, I interviewed a professor at Rutgers University who said we were already seeing drug-resistant or antibiotic-resistant germs, microorganisms, bacteria, because we had been using too much. That was a long time ago. We're even using more now. And finally, from our health segment today, prolonged fasting reboots the immune system. From the University of Southern California, quote, results of a new study on mice in a phase 1 trial of humans suggest that prolonged cycles of fasting, 2 days at a time, not only protect against toxic effects of chemotherapy, but also trigger stem cell regeneration of new immune cells and clearing out the old damaged cells. The study by researchers from the University of Southern California and published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell Stem Cell is the first to show that a natural intervention can trigger regeneration of an organ or system through stem cells. The team believes the findings could benefit people with immune system damage. For example, if people receive chemotherapy treatment for cancer, they could also benefit the elderly whose immune systems are weakened through aging. That's good news. Now, of course, that's not new to people listening to this program because you remember I had on a Dr. Alan Cox way back. And Dr. Cox was the only physician in New York at the time who was using fasting. And again, we're not talking about long-term fasting, and it's not just without any nutrient intake. He was giving liquid intake, lots of juices throughout the day and a protein shake, but no solid food, and was able to substantially help people with all forms of disease. It's nice to know that other research is supporting that. From our public health segment today, this is from Common Dreams, and it's a new report that reveals that the U.S. healthcare system is the most expensive in the world. It delivers the worst care among the industrialized nations that were studied, which shows just further proof that the private insurance model is broken. Quote, the only solution is to move away from the private insurance model that keeps cost and real care, costs up and care down. And what we need is a publicly and equitably funded universal health care system. That's part of it, but it's not the whole thing. And here's countries that have better health care systems than we do with better outcomes. Australia, Canada, France, Germany, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, the United Kingdom, and then dead last, the United States. And yet we spend way more than anyone else, and we get worse results. Because we don't look at the person as a whole human being. We look at the person merely as a, well, we look at the person as a series of broken diseases to which a medical model is all that we're going to do. Now, if we had universal health care and had preventative care, where we actually help people by learning how to shop, how to prepare foods, even how to eat, the nutritional value of different vegetables and fruits and beverages, if we had a real alternative in a school, and that's crucial, and if we gave people in hospitals healthy food instead of the garbage they feed them, big difference it would make. From our environmental segment today, right up front, Europe bans American apples. From Christina Sarich, the Natural Society. Now you'd think that the quintessential American apple would be universally appreciated. And I guess it would be, except what they don't want is they don't want DPA. Diphenylamine, a substance which keeps them from turning brown for months at a time when they're kept in storage. And that is the problem because, you see, it breaks down into carcinogenic elements, and it's been used since 1962. It was banned by the European Union in 2012, and So when you detect chemicals in apples that are carcinogenic, nobody's going to eat that. Oh, except Americans, because our USDA and FDA are completely under the control of special interest. That's why eating organic is so important. And speaking about organic, I want to thank all of the thousands, possibly tens of thousands of you living in New York who came to the call of to action last week after Ronnie Cummins was on, and we talked about a bill that was trying to be passed that would put a moratorium on fracking in New York State. And it worked. We did a couple of programs on it. Quote from Brandon Baker, Echo Watch: New York's General Assembly passed a moratorium on fracking Monday with a sensible question in mind. Why rush? Quote, we have heard from thousands of residents across the state about many issues associated with hydrofracking, and prudent leadership demands that we take our time to address all these concerns, end quote, said New York Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver. Quote, we do not need to rush into this. The natural gas deposits within the Marcellus Shale are not going to go anywhere. And indeed, the three-year moratorium of oil and natural gas drilling permits by an 89-34 vote count to allow for more time to study the environmental impact of the practice. That is good news, and we will continue to keep you informed. Just so you know, my office it sends out enormous amounts of information and resources to environmental groups, health groups all over the world. In fact, just last week, Seeds of Death was shown throughout the entire United Arab Emirates on television. How many people, we don't know, watched, but I was told it could be in the tens of millions. And so, if you have a need, if you need articles, if you need, and all of our material, by the way, is fully vetted for accuracy. We have lawyers on staff, we have scholars on staff, and so we always assume that any article, any documentary, any information we put out on any topic should be able to withstand cross-examination in a court of law. That's the quality of the material we use. If you want to read our latest articles, just go to blog.garynull.com. You'll see articles, you'll see videos, and documentaries. I'd like to welcome all of you. We have a lot of people listening from around the world. And here's some good news from Oxford University. From Gemma Collins, quote, University of Oxford has passed a motion to ban meat products and only serve vegan food for 5 nights a week on campus. Founded in 1610, Wadham consists, which is a college of University of Oxford in England, consists of 150 graduates and 450 undergraduates. It was one of the first colleges to admit women and is known for its progressive attitude. Oxford is made up of more than 30 different colleges, and Wadham's student union meets every fortnight. At a recent meeting, James Kenham, a fourth-year engineer, proposed the motion of serving vegetarian food for 4 nights. And a second-year history student then said it literally to make a change, it should be amended to 5 days of vegan food, which was passed. The motion said, quote, reducing the consumption of meat is one of many steps needed to reduce the effects of climate change. Quote, excessive meat consumption is harmful to the environment and could also lead to an increased risk of certain cancers like bowel cancer. Quote, 5 days of vegan food may sound intimidating to students across the country and even some of the students, but that's good. So first to do it that I know of. So why don't we ask, we have a lot of teachers and professors listening, why don't we try to implement the same thing in your school, at least on a trial basis, at least make it available for people to try. And finally, from our environmental segment today, from Natural News, Ethan Huff, Oregon governor nullifies county-level bans on GMOs. Quote, Oregon's GMO sellout, how the governor caved to corporate pressure. A majority of voters in several Oregon counties have made it clear that they do not want genetically modified organisms in their communities. But Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber, a Democrat, recently sold them down the river by affixing his signature to a bill that blocks individual counties throughout Oregon from passing their own agricultural ordinances, in this case, ones that prohibit the use of biotechnology. The new law was sneakily added by state Republicans to an unrelated bill dealing with funding for public employee retirement education. It emerged following talks throughout the state of imposing local bans on GMO crops. As Oregon has been a home rule state that recognizes both chartered and non-chartered counties as having autonomous freedom to establish their own rules and guidelines independent from the state. So when news of a possible GMO ban reached the ears of biotech executives, special interest lobbying groups immediately kicked into high gear to stop it. Reports indicate that big agri corporations spent hundreds of thousands of dollars convincing cowardice legislators to sneak a provision into the unrelated bill, which was discussed at a special session called last fall by the governor. So, governor, you're being accused of pimping for special corporate interest. Is it true? I invite you to come on the program to debate me on GMOs. If you are not up on the topic, please bring a pro-GMO person with you, as I believe the audience would benefit to hear from the pro-GMO, but from those of us, myself, Jeffrey Smith, Vandana Shiva, Ronnie Cummins, who are extremely knowledgeable about organic gardening. And I've been an organic gardener, certified organic gardener, teaching gardening, written on GMOs, and did a documentary on GMOs. Possibly the governor is not aware of the history of GMOs and how bad they are. So let's have a discussion on it. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. We have a lot more, and we're going to start our commentaries and go to I'll stop the commentaries to have a discussion at the end so you can call in and share your points of view. Please stay with us. Back in a moment. Have you with us, everyone? When I receive the statistics each day, when I'm on the road, as I am now, and I see how many new listeners are coming on board, it's always very exciting, and we're happy to get your feedback. And for the people in California, I'll be doing one stop in the next 6 months there. That'll be the first week of September to premiere at a major theater, the Poverty Inc. I'll give you more information on that in another month. We're going to take just a couple minutes here to give you a special of the day. And I ask our staff in New York, come up with a dynamic special, something that is a super savings that people would benefit from. And they came up with two. It's a package. And here's the package. Three bottles, that's a three-month supply, of olive leaf extract. Oh, olive leaf. Just Google olive leaf or olive leaf extract. What we know is that there's a unique compound within it that is extremely beneficial. Olive leaves contain high amounts of oleoerythrine, which makes their extracts a valuable source of a nutrient that makes olive oil so important. And it has so many benefits. I can't tell you what it does. There are multiple conditions that it impacts with, just multiple. So that's the olive leaf extract. And plus the Garcinia cambogia. Garcinia cambogia is a small, it's a pumpkin-shaped fruit called the tamarind. And the natural extract from the rind of this fruit is called hydroxycitric acid, or HCA, which for people who are looking at ways to help themselves, especially if they tend to be overweight, very beneficial. So there are studies on it, and especially look for the studies that focus upon serotonin and mood and sleep. So Garcinia cambogia extract, olive leaf extract, the best possible type in vegan capsules. Now, the normal price of three bottles of each, that's a 3-month supply of each one, would be $123. Your cost today, $50. You save more than $70, just $50 for what amounts to 6 bottles of this, 3 and 3. 3 bottles of olive leaf extract, which everyone should have at home. It's one of the 10 essential things you put into your natural cabinet. And Garcinia cambogia, 90 capsules, vegan. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. That's a great special. Now for some commentaries. And I'm happy to see that they're making an effort to rescind Citizens United. This is from Angela Bradbury and Carolyn Gower. Quote, "The Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights Subcommittee of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee today will consider and vote on S.J. Res. 19, a constitutional amendment proposed by U.S. Senator Tom Udall, Democrat of New Mexico, that aims to overturn Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission and other U.S. Supreme Court decisions relating to campaign finance. Public citizens will be available to comment on the amendment right after today's markup." So they're going after him. If it's not too late, contact your legislator. I'll give you a contact number, 202-588-7741. That's Angela's number, 202-588-7741. And she can direct you to contact your personal state representative on this. It's about time people started to deal with this. It's really critical. I don't have a lot of time right now to watch anything. But what I do watch, I see is complete propaganda and misinformation. The very people who were all over the media banging the drums for us to get into Iraq or Afghanistan are back at it. That's just amazing to me, because they lied or stupid or misinformed, take your pick, and on everything about the Iraq war, as we have been about Libya and Syria and the Ukraine. And why these people are not called out is amazing. But John Scales Avery has a point of view. I'd like to share that with you. It is entitled, "Why is the military-industrial complex sometimes called the devil's dynamo?" Quote, "The military-industrial complex involves a circular flow of money. The money flows like the electrical current in a dynamo, driving a diabolical machine. Money from immensely rich corporate oligarchs buys the votes of politicians and the propaganda of the mainstream media. Numbed by the propaganda, citizens allow the politicians to vote for obscenely bloated military budgets, which further enrich the corporate oligarchs, and the circular flow continues." The dynamos of today has led to a modern version of colonialism and empire. It is therefore interesting to look at the first global era of colonialism. In the 18th and 19th century, the continually accelerating development of science and science-based industry began to affect the whole world. As the factories of Europe poured out cheap manufactured goods, a change took place in the patterns of world trade. Before the Industrial Revolution, trade routes to Asia had brought Asian spices and textiles and luxury goods to Europe. For example, cotton cloth and fine textiles woven in India were imported to England. With the intervention of spinning and weaving machines, the trade was reversed. Cheap cotton cloth manufactured in England began to be sold in India, and the Indian textile industry withered, just as the hand loom industry in England itself had done a century before. The rapid development of technology in the West also opened up an enormous gap in military strength between the industrialized nations and the rest of the world. Taking advantage of their superior weaponry, the advanced industrial nations rapidly carved out the remainder of the world into colonies, which acted as sources of raw materials and food, and as markets for manufactured goods. Throughout the American continent, the Native American population had proved vulnerable to European diseases like smallpox, and large numbers of them had died. The remaining Indians were driven westward by streams of immigrants arriving from Europe. The sometimes genocidal wars waged by industrial nations against the inhabitants of Asia, Africa, and the Western Hemisphere often involved almost unimaginable cruelty. We can think, for example, of the atrocities committed by the army of Leopold II in Belgium, Congo, where more than 10 million people were killed out of a total population of 20 million. In Leopold's Congo, human hands became a source of currency. This was because the men in Leopold's army were ordered to cut off the hands of their victims to prove that they had not wasted their bullets. We can also think of distribution of smallpox-infected blankets to the Americans, or the unbelievable treachery and cruelty of conquistadors in Central America and South America. Often the industrialized nations made their will felt by means of naval bombardments. In 1854, Commander Perry forced Japan to accept foreign traders by threatening to bombard Tokyo. In 1856, British warships bombarded Canton in China to punish acts of violence against Europeans living in the city. In 1864, a force of European and American warships bombarded Chushu in Japan, causing a revolution. In 1882, Alexandria was bombarded. In 1896, Zanzibar. Much that was beautiful and valuable was lost as mature traditions collapsed. Overcome by the power and temptations of modern industrial civilization, for the Europeans and Americans, the late 19th and early 20th century, progress was a religion. Imperialism was its crusade. Between 1800 and 1875, the percentage of the Earth's surface under European rule increased from 35% to 67%. In the period between 1875 and 1914, there was a new wave of colonial expansion, and the fraction of the Earth's surface under the domination of colonial powers, mainly Europe, United States, and Japan, increased to 85%. The unequal and unfair contest between the industrialized countries armed with modern weapons and the traditional cultures that are much more primitive arms was summarized by the English poet Belcock in a sardonic couplet, quote, "Whatever happens, we have got the Maxim gun, and they have not." The Maxim gun was one of the world's first automatic machine guns. It was invented in the United States in 1884 by Hiram Maxim. The explorer and colonist Henry Morton Stanley was extremely enthusiastic about Maxim's machine gun, and during a visit to the inventor, he tried firing it, demonstrating that it really could fire 600 rounds per minute. Stanley commented that the machine gun could be, quote, "a valuable tool in helping civilization to overcome barbarism." During the period between 1880 and 1914, British industrial and colonial dominance began to be challenged. Industrialism had spread from Britain to Belgium, Germany, and the United States, and to a lesser extent France, Italy, Russia, and Japan. By 1914, Germany was producing twice as much steel as Britain, and the United States was producing four times as much. New techniques and weaponry were introduced, and a navy filled with armaments began a race among the major industrial powers. The English found their old navy was obsolete, and they had to be rebuilt. Thus, the period of colonial expansion between 1880 and 1914 was filled with tensions as the industrial powers raced to arm themselves in competition with each other and raced to seize as much as possible the rest of the world. The English economists Fabian and John Atkins Hobson offered a famous explanation of the colonial era in his book Imperialism, a Study. According to Hobson, the basic problem that led to colonial expansion was an excessively unequal distribution of incomes in the industrialized countries. The result of this unequal distribution was that neither the rich nor the poor could buy back the total output of their society. The incomes of the poor were insufficient, and the rich were too few in number. The rich had finite needs and tended to reinvest their money. As Hobson pointed out, reinvestment in new factories only made the situation worse by increasing output. Hobson had been sent as a reporter by the Manchester Guardian to cover the Second Boer War. His experiences had convinced him that colonial wars have an economic motive. Such wars are fought, he believed, to facilitate investment of the excess money of the rich in African or Asian plantations and mines, and to make possible the overseas sale of excessive manufactured goods. Hobson believed imperialism to be immoral, since it entails suffering, both among colonial peoples and among the poor in the industrial nations. The cure that he recommended was a more equal distribution of manufacturing countries. Industrial and colonial rivalry contributed to the outbreak of the First World War, to which the Second War can be seen as a sequel. The Second World War was terrible enough to make world leaders resolve to end the institution of war once and for all, and the United Nations was set up for this purpose. Article 2 of the UN Charter requires, quote, all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against territorial integrity or political independence of any state. The Nuremberg principles, which were used in the trial of Nazi leaders after World War II, explicitly outlawed, quote, crimes against peace, planning, preparation, initiation, or waging war of aggression or war in violation of international treaties, agreements, or assurances, participation in a common plan or conspiracy for the accomplishment of any acts mentioned herein. With the founding of the United Nations at the end of the Second World War, a system of international law was set up to replace the rule of military force. Law is a mechanism of equality. Under law, the weak and the powerful are in principle equal. The basic purpose of the United Nations is to make war illegal. And if war is illegal, the powerful and the weak are on equal footing, much to the chagrin of the powerful. How can one construct or maintain an empire if war is not allowed? It's only natural that the powerful nations should be opposed to international law, since it is to curb their power. However, despite opposition, the United Nations was quite successful in ending the original era of colonialism, perhaps because the balance of power between East and West during the Cold War. One by one, former colonies regained their independence, but it was not to last. The original era of colonialism was soon replaced by neo-colonialism and the American Empire. And that brings us to the two world wars of the 20th century involved a complete reordering of the economies of the belligerent countries, and a dangerous modern phenomenon was created, the military-industrial complex. In his farewell address in 1961, President Dwight David Eisenhower warned of the dangers of the war-based economy that World War II had forced his nation to build. Quote, we have been compelled to create an armaments industry of vast proportions. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and large arms industry is new in American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office in the federal government. We must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved, so it is the very structure of our society. We must stand guard against the acquisition of unwanted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. End quote. This very far-sighted speech by Eisenhower deserves to be studied by everyone who's concerned about the future of human civilization and biosphere. As a retiring president pointed out, the military-industrial complex is a threat both to peace and to democracy. It is not unique to the United States, but exists in many countries. Today, the world spends roughly $1.7 trillion each year on armaments. It is obvious that very many people make their living from war, and therefore it is correct to speak of war as a social, political, and economic institution. Now, the military-industrial complex needs enemies. Without them, it would be of no value. Thus, at the end of the Second World War, the vast power complex was faced with a crisis. But it was saved by the discovery of a new enemy, communism. The United States emerged from the two global wars as America's dominant industrial power, taking over the position that Britain had held during the 19th century. The economies of its rivals had been destroyed by the two wars, but no fighting had taken place in American soil. And because of its unique position as the only large country whose economy was completely intact in 1945, the United States found itself suddenly thrust almost unwillingly into the center of the world's political stage. The new role as leader of the free world was accepted by the United States with a certain amount of nervousness. America's previous attitude had been isolationism, a wish to be free from the wars and quarrels of Europe. After the Second World War, however, this was replaced by a much more active international role. And that is what led us into the Cold War. Anyhow, I just wanted to share this with you because we have been engaged nonstop in war since 1945. Most Americans don't know that. They'll know the Afghanistan War and the Iraq War. They don't know what we were doing in Greece, Philippines, Albania, and other countries. Ours is a sordid story, but our history needs to be told. This is from William Polk from Consortium. America appears to be on the brink of another war. This time, the conflict is likely to involve Syria or Iraq. If we jump into one or both of these wars, that will bring the number of significant military operations since America's independence from Great Britain to about 200 interventions. Not all, of course, were officially wars. There were also many proactive intervention, regime change undertakings, covert action schemes, and search and destroy missions. In addition, the United States has provided weapons, training, and funding for a variety of non-American military, quasi-military forces throughout the world, including five new African countries in recent months. History and contemporary events show that we Americans are a warring people. So we should ask, what have we learned about ourselves, our adversaries, and the processes in which we have engaged? As both a historian and a former policy planner for the U.S. government, I will very briefly illustrate what I mean. I begin with us, the American people. There is overwhelming historical evidence the war is popular with us. Politicians from our earliest days as a republic, indeed even before we were British colonies, could nearly always count on gaining popularity by demonstrating valor. Few successful politicians were pacifists. Even supposed pacifists found reason to engage in the use of force. Take the man most often cited as the peacemaker, or at least the peace seeker, President Woodrow Wilson. He promised to, quote, keep us out of war, by which he meant avoiding big, expensive European wars. The so-called Great War, better known as World War I. But did you know that before becoming president, Woodrow Wilson approved the American conquest of Cuba and the Philippines, describing himself as an imperialist? And then, as president, he occupied Haiti, sent the Marines to the Dominican Republic and ordered the cavalry into Mexico. By 1917, Woodrow Wilson also plunged the United States into European conflict on the side of Great Britain, France, and their allies. In 1918, Wilson put American troops into Russia to fight the Bolsheviks. The purpose and explanation of our wars have varied. For many conflicts, particularly those against Native Americans, would today be classified as war crimes. But strange justifications can be mounted for the Revolutionary War, the First World War, and the Second World War. And, however, it is in the middle grouping of American wars that seemed to me most important to understand. I think most students of history would put the Spanish-American War, the Vietnam War, the Iraq War, and several others into a category that we shouldn't have been there. Basically, the government lied to us. The Spaniards did not blow up the USS Maine. The Gulf of Tonkin was not a dastardly attack on innocent U.S. ships. And Iraq was not about to attack the United States with nuclear or chemical weapons. But we citizens listened uncritically. We did not demand the facts. It's hard to avoid the charge that we were complicit, lazy, or ignorant. And afterwards, we did not hold our government to account. Several wars and other forms of intervention were justified by supposed local or regional requirements of the Cold War. We were told another that the domino theory in Indochina was real, so any hint of communism, subversion, or even criticism of U.S. policy sent us racing off to protect almost any form of political association that pretended to be on our side. We had behaved or feared that even countries that had little or no connection with one another would topple at the first touch of communism contamination, even before their neighbors appeared to be in trouble. Therefore, regardless of their domestic political style, monarchs, dictatorships, despotic regimes, these governments had to be protected. Our protection often included threats of invasion, paramilitary operations, subversion, bribery, and direct intervention, all in support of our proclaimed intent to keep them free, at least from the Soviet control. We did this in Guatemala, Nicaragua, Brazil, Chile, Italy, Greece, Syria, Lebanon, Iran, Indonesia, Vietnam, and various African countries. Some interventions involved acquisition of their resources or protection of U.S. economic interests. Guatemala, Chile, Iraq, Iran, and Indonesia come to mind. Few, if any, of these conflicts were to establish peace or even to bring about ceasefires. The costs of all these conflicts have been high. Just counting fairly recent interventions since World War II, they have cost America over 100,000 dead and over $10 trillion in money. Beyond the staggering cost, the rate of success of these foreign conflicts has been low. Failure to accomplish the desired or professed outcome is shown by the facts that within the few years of the initial American intervention, the condition that precipitated the U.S. involvement had reoccurred. This rate of failure has dramatically increased in recent years. That is because we are operating in a world with heightened political sensitivities and global public awareness of these events. Today, even poor, weak, and uneducated and corrupt nations become focused by the actions of foreigners. Whereas before, a few members of the native elite made the decisions, today we face various national fronts, including political parties, tribes, and independent opinion leaders. And I believe in conclusion that there are many aspects to this. One is nationalism. This is why we are a warring nation. Nationalism has been and remains the predominant way of political thought of most of the world's people. Its power has long been strong. It was given impetus by the emergence of communism and popular demands for more equitable economic structure. Religion has also played a part. Today, nationalism in Africa, much of Asia, and parts of Europe is increasingly magnified by the rebirth of Islam in the movements. Attempts to crush these nationalistic, ideological, religious, cultural movements militarily have generally failed. When foreigners arrive on the scene, local inhabitants tend to put aside their mutual hostilities to unite against the outsider. Then you have radicalization. Outside intervention has usually weakened local moderate or conservative forces, or at least those more stable tendencies with national movements. People espousing the most extreme positions are more likely to prevail against the invaders. Thus, particularly in protracted hostilities, extremists are more likely to take charge than their moderate domestic rivals. Also, we have short memories. America's institutional memory of programs, events, and trends is shallow, usually no longer than a decade. Thus, we repeat policies even when the record clearly shows that they didn't work when previously tried, and we address each challenge as though it is unprecedented. We forget the American folk saying, when you find yourself in a hole, best course of action is to stop digging. It isn't only the United States government and their so-called thousands of experts, tacticians, and strategists. They don't remember the past mistakes they made, but they often reject the obvious lessons and decide that what they need to do is to get a bigger shovel. Despite America's immigrant origins, we are profoundly insular people. Few of us have much appreciation of non-American cultures and even less empathy for them. Within a generation or so, few immigrants can even speak the language of their grandparents. Many even shun their ethnic origins. And that is one other thing. And also we have the final issue on that was constitutional restraint. So what do we do? At the time of the writing of the American Constitution, there was a man named Morris, the principal author of the famous preamble. And he remarked that one of the framers' goals was to, quote, save the people from their most dangerous enemies, themselves. He and other delegates to the Constitutional Convention were especially frightened by the dangers of militarism and tried to restrain the temptation towards unnecessary warfare by imposing checks and balances, such as dividing the war-making powers between executive and legislature. The nation's early leaders, including President George Washington, John Adams, certainly did not look to the military to solve problems of policy. They would have agreed, I feel sure, that very few of the problems that America faced could be solved by military means. They did what they could to keep the young country out of the ongoing conflict between France and England. I believe that many of the framers would be horrified by the national security state that the United States has become and the gunslinger mentality of careless military actions that has taken hold. Over the past several decades, the United States has been frequently misled by the successes of post-war policies toward both Germany and Japan. Perhaps consequent to those successes when the U.S. decided to destroy the regimes of Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi, little thought was given to what would follow. U.S. policymakers just assumed that things would get better, but they did not. The societies imploded. Had U.S. forces invaded Iran as another regime change experiment, the results would have been even a moral, legal, and economic greater disaster. By now, Americans should know that we should not make proactive war on foreign nations. And beyond the practical efforts, the United States has sworn not to engage in aggressive warfare as part of the treaty created by the UN. In short, we need to be law-abiding, and we should look before we leap. We should weigh all the factors. End quote. And William Polk is a veteran foreign policy consultant and author and professor who taught Middle Eastern studies at Harvard. And President Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, appointed Polk to the State Department's Policy Planning Council. I'm Gary Noll. Finally, this from C.J. Werleman from Alternet. Americans are dangerously politically ignorant. The numbers are shocking. The health of a democracy is dependent upon educated citizenry. Political illiteracy is the manure for the flourishing of political appeals based upon sheer ignorance. In fact, in his victory speech delivered last week to his supporters, Tea Party activist David Brat said that he sits among the majority of Americans who, quote, I wish to restore Americans to its Judeo-Christian roots. God acted through people on my behalf, end quote. Well, ignoring this self-delusion, the latter part of what I just read, Brat now joins no less than 200 million Americans, according to a number of polls, who believe the U.S. Constitution and our laws are based upon Judeo-Christian values. On any given Sunday, you will hear Christian right-wing politicians claim absurdly the U.S. law is based on the Bible. Well, here's a spoiler alert. You're all dead wrong. The Constitution's secular provisions came into being thanks to the Founding Fathers, who shared a deep suspicion of both organized religion and the supernatural. The Constitution was framed with a conscious omission of any mention of God and a prohibition of all religious texts for public office. Moreover, the First Amendment's declaration that, quote, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion embodies the founders' view that religion has no place in the political domain. Now, that not a single major media outlet bothered to correct Bratt's ignorance represents America's continual decline in our cultural illiteracy. Quote, every shortcoming of American governments is related in some fashion to the knowledge deficit of the public, if only because there is no widespread indignation at policy shaped by elected officials who suffer from the same intellectual blind spots as their constituents, end quote, from the Age of American Unreason. The nation's collective ignorance as it pertains to culture and civic literacy paves the way for extremist politicians to convince the public of the validity of extreme positions. So how bad is it? In conclusion, a National Constitutional Center poll found that 2/3 of Americans could not name all three branches of the U.S. federal government, not a single Supreme Court justice. Another poll found that 91% could not name the current Chief Justice. Amazing. It gets worse. When residents were asked whether they could recall any of the rights guaranteed in the First Amendment, a majority could name only free speech. More than a third were unable to list any First Amendment rights. A National Constitutional Center also found 42% of Americans think the Constitution explicitly states that the, quote, the first language of the United States is English. It does not. And 25% believe Christianity was established in the Constitution as the official government religion. No religion was. And only 40% of adults know that there are 100 senators in the U.S. Congress, while a great majority of Americans simply have no idea of when or whom the Constitution was written. A Pew Research Center survey of America's knowledge of public affairs and politics revealed that political literacy has been in rapid and continual descent since the high water mark in the 1950s. So this rising tide of ignorance threatens the very foundation of American democracy. It was Bertolt Brecht, and I had a chance to work on one of his manuscripts when I was very young as a ghostwriter with the Writers' Literary Agency. He was a 20th century German playwright and poet, and he wrote, the worst illiterate is the political illiterate. He doesn't hear, he doesn't speak, nor participates in the political events. He doesn't know the cost of life, the price of beans, the fish, the flour, of the rent, of the shoes, of the medicine, all depends on political decisions. The political illiterate is so stupid that he is proud and swells his chest saying that he hates politics. The imbecile doesn't know that from his political ignorance is born the prostitute, the abandoned child, and the worst thieves of all, the bad politician, corrupted and flunky of the nation and national in all. Brecht nails it. Political illiteracy is what propels middle-class workers to protest expansion of collective bargaining laws, like was happening recently in Tennessee when Volkswagen allowed its workers to vote for union membership by holding placards sponsored by Americans for Prosperity. If there was a better example of Orwellian genius than Americans for Prosperity, I haven't seen it. I mean, who doesn't want prosperity? But less than 10% of Americans know that Americans for Prosperity is a political action committee wholly and solely funded by the David and Charles Koch people. Its sole purpose is to ensure continued prosperity for David and Charles Koch, which ultimately comes at the expense of the very people who are holding the placards. So an embrace of infantile emotionalism has supplanted political literacy. More on this on our next program. I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Thank you very much for listening. Let's say hello to Utrecht Lead. Hi, Utrecht.
Hey, today we're talking about a showdown in Tallahassee, Florida, to restore the voting rights of 1.5 million ex-offenders who have been permanently barred from voting. And scholar Tariq Ali puts the crisis in Iraq in political and historical perspective.
Excellent. Right now, Utrecht Lead.